The content of the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is for informational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare show. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Focus on Females does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the radio show. Reliance on any information provided by Focus on Females or others appearing on the show at the invitation of Focus on Females is solely at your own risk. Now, it's time for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Here we create clarity out of confusion and guide you through today's healthcare maze. Each week, we'll focus on a different medical topic with a guest expert answering your questions. Future topics and guests can be seen at www.focusonfemales.com. Call in between 12:30 and 1 p.m. on Sundays and present your case to our experts. To get involved with today's clinic, call now in Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be proactive with your health. We're here to focus on you. And now, our host, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is on, and we thank you for listening. Today we're tackling hepatitis C with guest expert Dr. Dennis Feldman of the Florida Medical Clinic. But first, this radio show and the free annual Focus on Females Healthcare Symposium, now the largest in the country with 1,800 women, is supported by the not-for-profit Focus on Females Education Foundation, whose mission is to create an interactive, dynamic, community-based healthcare safety net, making you an expert on your personal medical needs. The result? Better partnering with your existing doctor, leading to more effective office visits, faster results, and a reduced economic burden of avoidable medical and emergency care. We save lives and protect families through health education. And again, today, we have the good fortune of having Dr. Dennis Feldman with us. Dennis, good to see you today.
Nice to be here.
Now, Dennis and I did a show on celiac disease back in August, and so we welcome Dennis back for his second appearance on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Dr. Dennis Feldman has been in the practice of gastroenterology in the Tampa Bay area over the past 25 years. He is currently a member of the Florida Medical Clinic with offices in North Tampa and Land of Lakes, Florida. He's board certified by the American College of Physicians in Internal Medicine and Gastroenterology. He is an active member of the American College of Gastroenterology and the American Society for Gastrointestinal Endoscopy. Dr. Feldman's clinical interests include celiac disease, colon cancer screening, inflammatory bowel disease, biliary tract and liver disease, and endoscopic procedures including endoscopy and colonoscopy. Dr. Feldman was born in New Jersey, attended college at Colgate University, and graduated from George Washington University Medical School. He then completed his internship, residency, and gastroenterology fellowship, all at the University of South Florida. When he's not taking care of patients, his interests include road biking, master swimming, and snow skiing. All right. And so, today we're talking about hepatitis C, and we encourage everybody out there who either has hepatitis C or is at risk to develop or contract hepatitis C, or knows someone maybe in the family with hepatitis C and is concerned about these individuals or loved ones, now's the time to call in with questions. And our phone number is 289-1860. That's 289-1860. And outside of Hillsborough County, it's 877-969-8600. That's 877-969-8600. And we encourage phone calls from everywhere. All right. Well, hepatitis C is a topic of conversation. What is hepatitis C?
Well, hepatitis C is a form of inflammation of the liver. Hepatitis refers to any is a general term that refers to any form of inflammation of the liver. Common causes of hepatitis include hepatitis A, hepatitis B, drug-induced hepatitis, inflammation caused by certain drugs or over-the-counter products.
But in this particular case, we're talking about a viral cause of inflammation of the liver.
Right. Hepatitis C is a distinct virus from hepatitis A and B. It has different characteristics in terms of its effect on the patient than these other causes of hepatitis.
Well, how common is hepatitis C?
There's apparently 4 million cases of hepatitis C in America, and the disease accounts for 8,000 to 13,000 deaths a year in the United States.
Okay. And so this disease is potentially a lethal disease. It can take someone's life.
That's true. Actually, the most common cause of chronic active hepatitis and advanced liver disease in the country right now is hepatitis C, and it has to do with some of the social factors and medical factors that existed from the 60s to the 90s. Since our technology has improved, fortunately, the generations behind us, there will be a lot lower incidence of hepatitis C than there currently is actively in the country right now. Actually, hepatitis C accounts for the most common cause for liver transplantation at this point. However, over the next 10 to 20 years, we will be seeing an ever-increasing incidence of hepatitis C. But then, due to changes in how we diagnose it, treat it, and find it, the incidence will actually decrease to be, unfortunately, supplanted by obesity accounting for liver disease.
Well, let's take a look at some of the things that you commented on. Why is there an increasing incidence of hepatitis C?
Patients who were exposed to the hepatitis C virus occurred due to contamination from infected individuals by blood or needle contact. So prior to the year 1990, there was no way to identify the virus in our blood and blood products. Patients who received blood clotting factors before 1987 were also exposed to this virus. And unfortunately, the most common exposure was recreational drug use during the 60s and 70s accounted for a significant percentage of patients who contracted hepatitis C and were unaware that they actually incurred the infection. Actually, even casual use of recreational intravenous drugs can result in a significant percentage of people being chronically infected. In fact, individuals who use these agents for as short a period of time as 6 months would have virtually a 90 to 100% chance of developing hepatitis C.
And as you mentioned, before 1992, if you were a blood transfusion recipient, also puts you at risk.
Yeah, so patients who were exposed to massive blood transfusion due to motor vehicle accidents, massive trauma, birth complications, who received multiple transfusions of blood were not completely detectable. Now, ironically, in the 60s and 70s, we had ways to check our donors for hepatitis A and B, and we were aware of the fact that people who received a lot of blood transfusions could conceivably develop hepatitis, but we did not have a way to characterize the virus. So we used a number of surrogate tests to prove who may have hepatitis C as a donor, and we constantly tried to exclude them from the donor pool of donating blood participants, but we could not. We didn't have the technology to.
Sure.
Yeah, we couldn't. We didn't have the technology to identify the virus specifically enough to exclude them from the blood pool. Fortunately, now the chance of developing hepatitis C from a unit of blood is virtually 1 in 2 million.
But how long, let's say a person has had a blood transfusion, for example, 1990 or 1985, how long should they, let's say they've not developed any signs of hepatitis, do they need necessarily to be continued to be concerned about this 20 years later?
Actually, they do. This is a risk factor for having hepatitis C. Risk factors are the only way that we can frequently find patients who have hepatitis C because unlike other hepatitis viruses, the acute illness is frequently quite self-limited. In other words, patients can have their acute exposure to hepatitis C, be unaware that they have hepatitis C because they could have a very mild disease. In fact, in most cases, they do have a mild disease, not associated with fevers, jaundice, right upper quadrant pain, or the usual circumstances that patients attribute to having an acute hepatitis virus. Nevertheless, even though they do not have those symptoms, they never clear the virus, and the virus smolders in their system, largely because the virus is an RNA virus that's very primitive, and because it keeps mutating, our own immune system seems to be unable to eradicate it.
What if blood tests were done on these patients that we're talking about, who received, say, a massive blood transfusions back in the 80s, and there was no sign of any elevation liver enzymes, there's no suggestion of any liver disease. Can the virus essentially be in latency and then be activated 20 years down the line?
Well, one of the broad tests that can find patients with hepatitis C is an elevation of some of the liver tests, the SGOT and the SGPT. They can be mildly elevated. This will frequently prompt more specific serological tests for hepatitis C and can confirm people who have chronic active hepatitis due to hepatitis C. But unfortunately, like everything in medicine, nothing is perfect. There are also patients who have chronic smoldering hepatitis C who have risk factors for hepatitis C who can have normal SGOTs and SGPTs.
Okay, and then years down the road, it becomes active, a more active case.
Well, what happens is some people live with this disease almost in consort with the virus, and the liver constantly becomes inflamed, and their liver function deteriorates, but so subtly that it's never detected throughout their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So they live with the virus throughout their lives without a problem. However, 20% of these people will develop cirrhosis of the liver, mm-hmm. and about 5% will go on to develop hepatocellular carcinoma.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, the dormancy of the virus or its lack of clinical symptoms do not always correlate with who has progression of the disease.
And there are ways to identify the presence of the virus in the blood, even in the setting of normal liver enzymes.
Right.
If one's clued in to the potential of a presence of that virus.
Yes. If patients are at risk or have specific risk factors, like the history we talked about, mm-hmm. recreational drug use or significant blood transfusion history prior to 1990, or our healthcare workers that have had accidental needle sticks, they can be checked by a simple antibody test for hepatitis C, and this test, like all tests, has a percentage of false negative and false positive tests. If that test is positive, then a PCR RNA viral load can be obtained on those patients to document that they have the virus actively in their system.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, but once again, call in with your questions, 289-1860. That's 289-1860. Outside of Hillsborough County, it's area code 877-969-8600. Be back in a flash.
Talk Radio 860 WGUL.
This radio healthcare program is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 5th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27, 2010, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679-2702. Thank you.
Do your eyes have a foreign body sensation or are scratchy and sandy? Do they burn, sting, or itch, or are heavy and tired? Maybe your eyes are sensitive to light or your eyelids achy and sore. Have you seen countless doctors and still can't find relief? Have they told you, sorry, but you'll have to live with this and nothing can be done for you? Well, first, it's likely you suffer from dry eye. And second, don't stand for those answers anymore. Just because someone else doesn't understand your dry eye problems, go to the only eye doctor in Central Florida that specializes exclusively in dry eye and related diseases. Meet with Dr. Stephen Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where you will be given up to 2 hours of face-to-face time with a doctor to get at the root cause of your dry eye pain, fluctuating vision, and redness, plus begin targeted therapy right away. Haven't you waited long enough?
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Focus on
And welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Health Care Clinic. I'm Dr. Maskin, and today we're discussing hepatitis C with guest expert Dr. Dennis Feldman of the Florida Medical Clinic. And let's go right to the phones. We have Deborah from Largo. Welcome to the Focus on Females Radio Health Care Clinic.
Hi, thank you, Doctor. My sister has had hep C for 14 years, and she is now in stage 4 cirrhosis. No liver doctor would give her any pain medication. I'm her caregiver, and she's just in excruciating pain. And they say that the liver cannot filter any pain medicine. I don't know what to do for her. I don't know where to go. We went to a pain management clinic. Do you have any suggestions or any medication that can help her?
Let me ask you, could you describe the nature of her pain?
She has bloat. She's been thin all her life, and her stomach has bloated excessively, like maybe 40 pounds worth. And she's sore around the liver and lower back pain constantly, in tears, can't sleep, can't bend, can't walk. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to take her.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Supposedly, she has a very good liver doctor, but they will not manage her pain, and I don't know why.
Is she constipated?
Constantly.
Okay, Dennis?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I would say that a relationship of hepatitis C and pain is not a direct one, in that patients who have advanced cirrhosis, stage 4 disease, who are beyond treatment with antiviral therapy, are not usually in extreme pain. Pain may be due to some other factor. Certainly, issues regarding pain in patients with advanced cirrhosis are screened for hepatocellular carcinoma, hepatoma, because the presence of a mass in the liver can be painful. Most patients with hepatitis C have small, shrunken livers and do not have pain from a massively enlarged liver, but no patients are exactly the same. Sometimes patients develop complications such as hepatic vein thrombosis, and the liver enlarges, and the pain can be due to the presence of an enlarging liver, because the liver is coated with a capsule called Glisson's capsule, and if the liver is acutely enlarged, it can cause a significant amount of pain just from the presence of the enlarging liver pressing on Glisson's capsule. Another thing to be considered is sometimes in the presence of advanced cirrhosis, the patient develops ascites or fluid in the abdomen, which can in and itself be painful. And sometimes a paracentesis, putting a small needle in the liver and draining several liters of that fluid out of the abdomen, alleviates the patient with advanced disease. So I would say, you know, obviously not knowing your sister, I really can't comment on specific things, but it should be important to determine if she has an enlarged liver or not, if there is any evidence of a mass in the liver on liver imaging, if there's elevation of a alpha fetoprotein, which is sometimes a monitor of a cancer in the liver, if there is any evidence of occlusion of the vein that drains the liver, mm-hmm. and if there's evidence of ascites. Fluid in the abdomen is sometimes present, and even a simple outpatient procedure, a paracentesis performed, can sometimes alleviate a significant amount of pain. Now, if all those things have been excluded, which may have been the case, then you get into some difficult issues, because obviously what your liver specialist has told you is true. Most narcotic medications and pain medications are metabolized through the liver, and it's very difficult to give them narcotic groups of medications.
Right, they will not.
Additionally, the other commonly used pain reliever that's mild in our society is aspirin. But unfortunately, patients with liver disease have portal hypertension, and as a result, they have a significant risk of intestinal bleeding or hemorrhage associated with administration of products that contain aspirin or aspirin as an adjunct. Then you get into the issue of Tylenol. Well, even right. in the stable patient with hepatitis C, we attempt to reduce their normal dosages of Tylenol because, you know, Tylenol is much more hepatotoxic in a patient even with early hepatitis C, but in advanced cirrhosis, it's obviously contraindicated. Then the other possibility is the use of some like low-dose codeine for pain control, but the problem that you do run into in patients with advanced liver disease is what we call portosystemic encephalopathy. Their tolerance for pain medication can be poor if they don't metabolize the medicine, and you can precipitate coma relatively easily before you reach a level where you develop pain control. So I understand your frustration, but unfortunately, we don't have great answers for the complexities of some of these issues.
And, Doctor, one other quick question. She was told that she takes a medication for ammonia that goes to the brain. What is that about?
If she has portal systemic encephalopathy, then her ability to tolerate proteins that she gets in her diet are impaired. So what happens is, in order to change the proteins that are in the diet to our own proteins, blood processes, though the food goes through the intestinal tract, through a special bloodstream that goes up into the liver, processes those proteins and turns them into our own proteins. However, in patients with portal hypertension, that gets impaired. So the proteins are unchanged, and they go through the liver and up to the brain, and they precipitate coma. So this syrup that she's taking, lactulose, kind of decreases the amount of protein that's in the intestine, so less protein in its raw form, unchanged by our liver, is sent to her liver, so there's less risk of her advancing to a coma state.
So, and lastly, evidently there is no cure, I understand. What is the prognosis? I mean, it's been 14 years. Is there a life expectancy?
I would say that patients who have what we call advanced decompensated cirrhosis unfortunately have a prognosis that's under 5 years. Now, there are patients, I don't want to stratify everybody on the radio, but patients can have compensated cirrhosis. They can have a lot of scarring in their liver and not
Let me interject here. Deborah, hang on. We'll be taking a little break. We'll be right back and discuss more of this case, okay?
Thank you so much.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic.
With SRN News, I'm Michael Harrington in Washington. Dick Durbin says the health care overhaul bill is headed for the Senate floor now and better pass before the year's up, or it might not. The Democratic senator from Illinois, the majority whip, tells NBC TV if debate goes into the next year, passage will become a lot harder. Some 1,800 bridges in northern England are getting emergency safety checks today. This after some of the worst storms ever recorded in Britain have saturated England's Lake District. More than 1,000 homes have been flooded, several river crossings destroyed. Police say the transportation network has been crippled by worries about bridge safety. It would appear that next month's climate summit in Copenhagen is going to be well attended. According to a Danish official, some 65 world leaders have already confirmed they are going to be there. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown is amongst them. He says it's important that final decisions can be made. More details at srnnews.com.
Foreclosure, divorce, business conflicts, you need to know your options, and we're here to help. I'm attorney Hunter Chamberlain of the Tampa law firm Chamberlain Patrick. Whether it's your home or business, your marriage, or you or a family member has been accused of a crime, having an experienced attorney on the case early can maximize your chances for a good outcome. Call Chamberlain Patrick today at 813-374-2216. That's 813-374-2216. Chamberlain Patrick, your business, your family, your home.
This radio healthcare program is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 5th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27, 2010, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679-2702. Thank you. Your host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is ophthalmologist and eye surgeon Dr. Stephen L. Maskin. Dr. Maskin is the medical director of the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, the proud sponsor of today's show. At the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, Dr. Maskin specializes in solving difficult dry eye and cornea disorders with patients traveling from over 35 states and 5 continents for his evaluation. Dr. Maskin manages these dry eye disorders using innovative medical and surgical therapies, including the use of placenta-derived amniotic membrane, a new patent-pending natural eye lubricant to provide relief for dry eye sufferers, an exciting new procedure to unblock obstructed tear glands, and a topical cure for eye surface cancer. Dr. Maskin has been successfully managing difficult dry eye cases for over 20 years and is board-certified, fellowship-trained, and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and American Academy of Ophthalmology. He's been selected a best doctor in America every year from 2000 through 2009 and as an America's top ophthalmologist by Consumers Research Council of America. We hope the Focus on Females education programs, including this show, will help you and your family find the health care that works for you. Focus on Females believes in saving lives and protecting families. And please, visit drmaskin.com, and if you have not found relief for your painful red dry eyes, come in to see Dr. Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where comfortable eyes lead to restored lives.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin. Focus on
Females. Welcome back on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Today's show is on hepatitis C with guest expert Dr. Dennis Feldman of the Florida Medical Clinic. And once again, our phone lines are open. It's 289-1860 in Hillsborough County. Elsewhere, area code 877-969-8600. On the line, hopefully, is Debbie. Are you still there?
I sure am.
Deborah's still here, and Deborah has been taking care of her sister, who's had hepatitis C for the last 14 years, is now at stage 4 cirrhosis of the liver, and had called in asking about the excruciating pain that her sister is having to deal with accompanied by, bloating and constipation.
Yes, that's correct.
And Dr. Feldman has discussed some of the diagnostic considerations as far as what the pain may be coming from. And I think we left off with your question, Deborah, of prognosis at this point.
Correct.
Dennis?
Okay. Just to kind of reiterate some of the things we talked before the break, a lot of patients can have a cirrhosis that is compensated and they won't be aware of it. And then patients have what's called decompensated cirrhosis. Decompensated cirrhosis is in situations where there are blood vessels in the esophagus, esophageal varices developing, portal hypertension, ascites, and problems like your sister have with encephalopathy, confusion that requires protein restriction and use of medication such as lactulose to reduce the amount of protein that gets processed through the liver. Now, the intention is to find patients with hepatitis C prior to this level of decompensated cirrhosis and use antiviral agents that we will talk about in a few minutes that may prevent this progression occurring. Unfortunately, once there is evidence of advanced cirrhosis, the only potential treatments that are curative at this stage of disease is transplantation of the liver, which is a very complicated topic, and patients have a fine window between when their cirrhosis is too advanced to consider transplantation and when transplantation is an option. Frequently, at the age of certain patients or due to comorbidities related to heart and lung disease and other medical problems, they may not be served by receiving a donor liver. And in reality, the hepatitis C reinfects the transplanted liver. So it's a very complicated issue in and of itself to pick the patients that would benefit the most from liver transplantation and not give them added morbidity associated with trying to transplant a patient that has too advanced disease.
And that's quite a weight also, I take it.
It's quite a, I would say, commitment. It requires a whole host of anti-rejection medications, and the patient has to be on antiviral treatment both during and after the transplantation process.
So. And she was on a chemo thing, but was a non-responder also.
Okay. Well, that was probably, we're probably going to get into that discussion in a few minutes. If you, stick with us, we're going to talk a little bit about how we choose who should stay on treatment and who isn't benefiting from treatment.
Okay. And, Doctor, where are you practicing?
I'm in North Tampa and Land O'Lakes.
And do you have a phone number or website?
Yes. My office number is 972-2324.
2324. Is that 813?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and I'll be listening about any further treatment or anything we can do to alleviate the bloating in her stomach.
I have a question, Debbie,
yeah,
before you go. What is the pain being ascribed to at this time?
They said inflammation of the liver. And her lower back pain, they don't know. She's had numerous MRIs, and they don't know. Nobody seems to know. I'm just a little frustrated. That's why I would like the doctor's number. I'd like her to come and see him.
Okay, excellent. Good luck, Deborah. And kudos to you for listening in and participating and becoming educated as to ways in which you may be able to help your sister. It's the only way. We have to take We have to take the initiative.
Because, yes, she's very proactive. She's on every website and the Hep C Foundation, and she reads all the updates. And unfortunately, there just doesn't seem to be a lot of – it's not a popular disease, and there's not a lot of information, and we just don't know who to go to or who to get awareness made about this disease that is becoming very, very common, more than HIV, evidently, the statistics show.
Well, if I can add my two cents, hone in on the diagnosis. Establish the diagnosis. Certainly, if she is constipated, that's got to add to the pain if it's not the sole reason for discomfort. And focus in on diagnosis and don't give up.
Okay, and thank you so much for your information. I'll be listening to the rest of the show.
Great. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
Once again, our number to call in with other questions about yourself, loved ones, family members, friends, 289-1860, and toll-free outside of Hillsborough County, it's 877-969-8600. So, Dennis, let's talk about treatment. Let's say you know you have or you've been discovered to have hepatitis C, positive serologies. Do all patients with positive hepatitis C serology require treatment if their liver enzymes are not particularly elevated and they feel pretty good?
Well, I think that's a lot of questions at once. But basically, I would say that patients need to be stratified in terms of whether their general medical status would permit them to consider antiviral treatment. We look at presence of elevation of liver enzymes alone cannot be relied upon to decide who should be treated or who should not be treated. Sometimes patients can have pretty prominent liver enzyme elevations, SGOT and SGPT, and on liver biopsy not have that much inflammation. The converse of that is also true, however. Sometimes patients can have very diminutive SGOT and SGPT elevations and have significant amount of inflammation on a liver biopsy that a liver biopsy warrants consideration for treatment. The other thing that's important is the viral load of the patient. Patients who have extremely high viral loads are likely to want to consider treatment. However, the viral load alone does not really tell much about the prognosis. Patients who have a low viral load, however, will have a greater likelihood of responding to the treatments that are available. One of the most important factors in terms of who would respond to treatment and who wouldn't respond to treatment has to do with the genotype. In other words, there are sub-classifications of the virus. In the United States, most cases are genotype 1, which unfortunately is less responsive to traditional treatment. However, with modern treatment practices, the use of pegylated interferon weekly and split-dosing ribavirin, patients with genotype 1 can respond to treatment approximately 60% of the time. Now, patients also present with genotype 2 or 3, which fortunately responds to treatment more favorably. Patients with genotype 2 or 3 can respond to treatment possibly as high as 80 to 90% of the time. Their treatment is also shorter. Patients with genotype 1 usually require 48 weeks of treatment, where patients with genotype 2 or 3 can require solely 24 weeks of treatment. Also, the dosing is different in the sense that patients who have genotype 2 or 3 fortunately can afford to be on a lower dose of ribavirin, which decreases the chance of side effects associated with the treatment.
All right, well, let's ask the question from the perspective of the patient. Patient comes in. What do you tell them as far as treatment? You test them, the serology is positive, you find out their genotype. What do you tell the patient as far as treatment?
First of all, we take a very thorough history and physical on the patient to determine what are the risks and benefits of treatment. Treatment should be offered to patients who don't have advanced cirrhosis because they're not going to benefit from the treatment. Patients, ironically, with very early disease, such as women who are under 35 years of age, who still are of childbearing era age, who have very mild inflammation, who are not likely to decompensate abruptly, may decide to defer treatment for a period of, let's say, 10 years and be re-biopsied, since this is a slowly progressive disease. And if they're monitored in terms of their appearance of their liver biopsy, they may defer treatment for several years before engaging in treatment until after they're of childbearing years.
And the reason for that would be?
Well, first of all, there is a significant amount of risk. Obviously, one of the agents used to treat hepatitis C is ribavirin, which is very teratogenic. So it can't be offered to somebody that's thinking about pregnancy.
Teratogenic meaning?
Chance of causing a birth defect. Right. Now, other factors that are important in terms of who should be treated or who should not be treated is in concordance with other lifestyle issues. It's important that the patient abstain from alcohol use in order to be considered for treatment, because the treatment is unlikely to be effective if it's done in the setting of use of alcohol. And then there are factors that stratify patients in terms of their likelihood of responding to treatment or not responding to treatment. They have to do with factors such as race, since unfortunately African Americans have a much lower response rate to antiviral treatment, and also obesity plays a factor as an independent factor in who might respond and not respond. If the liver biopsy shows evidence of fat in the liver, or there's clinical evidence of what we call insulin resistance, the chance of responsive therapy is lower. Ironically, there's also a very strong difference between females and males. Females will respond to the currently treatment regimens much more effectively than males. So to reiterate, early disease warrants consideration for treatment. Genotype 2 and 3 is more responsive to treatment. Low body weight is more responsive to treatment. Insulin resistance is a negative factor. Race unfortunately plays a role. So there's a lot to be considered in terms of who may benefit from treatment more or less. Then there are medical issues that enter into it. Patients who have manic depressive illness or depression have very severe risks by starting on the treatment available, and it's important that those illnesses are well compensated with medication before the patient be considered for treatment, but they certainly shouldn't be denied treatment. Also, patients with cardiac disease carry a very significant risk undergoing this treatment, because the ribavirin will cause anemia, and cardiopulmonary problems frequently exacerbate when the patient's placed on treatment and the hemoglobin drops. The regimen currently being used, unfortunately, will cause a drop in hemoglobin, white cell count, and platelet count, and they have to be followed very closely. So they have to be willing to handle a level of compliance and frequent office visits during treatment.
So also with ribavirin associated with anemia, then kidney disease could play a big role here too, with decreased erythropoietin production.
Well, actually, you know, that's an interesting point. Ribavirin is contraindicated in anybody with a creatinine clearance of under 50. So it's very unlikely.
Which is an indicator of kidney disease.
Right. So it's very unlikely that anybody with hepatitis C who has a very severe kidney disease or is on hemodialysis will even be allowed to take ribavirin. So they frequently have to be on just monotherapy, which is less effective, just the interferon alone.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take a quick break here. And again, open up the lines to phone calls. Our phone number is 289-1860, 289-1860. And outside of Hillsborough County, 877-969-8600. Call in with questions for yourself, loved ones, family members. Deborah, if you have a question based on the recent discussion of therapy, feel free to call back. We'll be right back with more.
This radio healthcare program is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 5th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27, 2010, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679-2702. Thank you. Confused about dry eye? Not getting answers as to why your eyes are so red and painful and your blurry vision that gets a little better with a good blink? Now you can learn all about dry eye, the causes, treatments, and home remedies from the number one best-selling consumer book on dry eye problems, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome by Dr. Stephen Maskin. Published by Yale University Press, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome has been selected as a 2008 Best Book of the Year by the Association of American University Presses and a 2007 Best Consumer Health Book by Library Journal. Find answers for your dry eye. Go to your bookstore and pick up a copy of Reversing Dry Eye. You'll be glad you did.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. I'm Steve Maskin, and today we have been discussing hepatitis C with guest expert Dr. Dennis Feldman of the Florida Medical Clinic. We have discussed a number of different aspects of hepatitis C. Let's talk more at this time, Dennis, about some of the important lifestyle changes that a person should make when they are found to have hepatitis C.
Firstly, I would say the most important factor would be exclusion of alcohol. Patients who have hepatitis C will have a slow progression of illness in most cases. Patients who drink alcohol, even in very mild to moderate quantities, will have a more rapid progression of the disease than other individuals.
How about something as mundane as mouthwash? Or do you recommend patients avoid that?
No, I don't think it's to that extent.
Okay.
But I would say that patients who tell you that they're a casual user of alcohol sometimes mean that they're having a glass of wine a day, one glass of wine a day. Well, if you have hepatitis C, that's too much alcohol. And I know there's a lot of effort made to say have one glass of red wine a day because it will reduce your cholesterol and be good for cardiac disease. Well, that may be true, but not in the patient with hepatitis C. At any stage of hepatitis
C. When you have active hepatitis, it trumps the other issues.
Trump card, that's right. The other thing I think that something I only became aware of recently was that patients who are frequent users of marijuana will have progression of their liver disease more actively than patients who are non-users. This comes up because patients frequently get anorexic during antiviral therapy. And marijuana is not a good choice for improving their appetite because it directly impairs the ability to respond to treatment and it progresses the disease. Mm-hmm. Other things that are important are body weight, BMI, and reducing insulin resistance. Patients have had this illness for several years and it progresses very slowly. The significance of that is so significant that we may tell a patient to come back in 2 years before we start treatment, because if we can lower their BMI, we can improve the response rate of traditional treatment. So avoidance of alcohol, avoidance of marijuana, reduction in body weight are all very important factors. Obviously, a balanced diet, adequate sleep, relief of stress are all very important factors.
How about tobacco use?
Tobacco use, I'm not aware of a specific factor, but obviously if you're considering treatment that involves risk to your cardiovascular system, tobacco would not be advocated.
Mm-hmm. And when you do initiate treatment, what factors will assist you in determining the adequate response to treatment?
Well, the main thing would be the genotype, the body mass index, the level of the viral load by PCR testing at the initiation of treatment. And there, as physicians, we look at three eponyms: the rapid virological response, the early virological response, and the sustained virological response. The sustained virological response means who has responded to treatment after it's completed and has negative laboratory or evidence of exclusion of the virus 6 months after the treatment is achieved. So the point is, our goal is to see a positive, beneficial SVR, sustained virological response, 6 months after we've completed treatment. This can be predicted by looking at the early virological response, which is how much of the virus is eradicated 4 weeks into treatment, and also looking at the early virological response. In other words, how much of the virus is present 3 months into treatment. So to try to make it simple, patients who have evidence of exclusion of the virus completely 4 weeks into treatment have an extremely high likelihood of sustained virological response. Mm-hmm. Patients who lower the viral load by 2 logs at 4 weeks also have a favorable response. Then we look at what happens at 3 months. If a patient shows either no decrease in virus at 3 months or less than a 2-log lowering of the viral content at 3 months, it's unlikely that we're going to achieve any benefit putting them through the risks of therapy.
Are there other therapies available aside from interferon and the ribavirin?
Well, people have looked at many different things to try to treat this virus, and it's a very difficult virus to treat. The reason being is it mutates frequently because it's almost an incomplete virus, and our immune system doesn't eradicate it, even if we try to maintain ourselves in the best of health. People have been looking to protease inhibitors or a third agent. Right now, the only thing that seems to be helpful in more refractory cases is higher dosages of ribavirin in refractory patients or continuing patients on longer courses of therapy if they show a response of at 3 months, but not a complete response.
Okay. And what are the risk factors, or what are the risks of hepatitis C treatment? I guess you mentioned anemia as one risk with ribavirin.
Right. Ribavirin causes hemolysis of the blood cells, lowering the blood cells. The combined treatment does lower white cell count and platelet count. There is a risk of activation of autoimmune diseases such as thyroid disease. It's difficult to treat patients who have other autoimmune diseases that are severe, such as systemic lupus erythematosus, rheumatoid arthritis, eczema, psoriatic arthritis. Other side effects include, which we touched upon before, activation of manic depressive illness, development of depression. Anorexia and weight loss is common. Hair loss in mild degree is also common.
Okay. We're getting ready to wrap up. Dennis, in 30 seconds, overarching comment on hepatitis C.
I think that hepatitis C is an important thing to keep in mind, and it's important to realize that it can be a silent illness. If you have risk factors, in other words, you've received blood transfusions or have had recreational drug abuse, even in the distant past, even in small amounts, it's important that you have yourself screened because the disease can progress silently.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Dennis Feldman for being with us this Sunday and next Sunday on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. We're tackling pterygium cancers and other growths on the eye. This is Steve Maskin. Have a great week, and we'll see you next Sunday on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Bye-bye.